Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEF CON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEF CON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
Hello? All right, we're going to continue with some cellular stuff. I think I'll sit down, this candle's too short. My name's Damian Thorne, I write for Nuts and Bolts Magazine. I wrote the... Thank you. Embarrassed me. I wrote the article that Mark was talking about that got a little bit less business than 2,600. Nuts and Bolts has a circulation of about 80,000, but I sometimes think that a target audience of 4,000 hackers, like 2,600 has, will do you a little better when you're selling hacker-related stuff. We're going to try to get some Motorola software rolling here. Are anyone familiar with Motorola software?
Yes.
About a year ago, a company called Cellular Press, which was a Beverly Hills mail drop for Spy Supply, a Massachusetts company, started selling software written about 3 years earlier than that that came from Europe somewhere. It allows you to essentially change NAM parameters, including the ESN, in a variety of Motorola phones. One of the problems with the software was that it didn't work on firmware versions above 9121. In 1991 sometime, Motorola changed a few things inside the phones that stopped the software from working. DT, we need you to turn the video back on. Okay. We'll see if this works. Anyway, well, they work on this. Another solution to altering Motorola phones, and I say altering, I mean cloning, whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of people and a lot of companies that are offering a service of duplicating the electronic identity from one phone into another. You still pay for your calls, but you have the convenience of two phones without paying too much to service fees. Which sounds legit to me. Apparently it's a violation of an FCC regulation that prohibits the alteration of a phone serial number. So you're kind of doing the same thing as running an unlicensed transmitter. You'll never really end up in the judicial system. You'll end up before the FCC's administrative stuff with a notice of apparent liability. Unless, of course, you copy someone's serial number and mobile number that doesn't belong to you. That's, of course, you know, in there with credit cards and all that. That's a no-no. Don't do that. Anyway, so we have a limitation on firmware of like 9121, which is, you know, means phones after 1991 pretty much aren't alterable with this software. And the one solution that's out apparently now is something that runs on laptops. It's protected with AccuMark Gold, which is a pretty kind of a crazy story in itself. Because it'll only run on the particular type of laptop it was installed on and things like that. I won't get into all that. The other solution that came out was high-tech hoods in New York referred to it as a trick clip. Basically, it consisted of old Motorola prom mounted on a 32-pin quad clip that you could open up your flip phone. Apparently, flip phones are what are really popular. And it would clip on top, you cut a pin on the chip, and the old firmware would take over while you programmed your new serial number, whatever trick clip or ginger changer spice supply column. We sold for about $300, about $60 worth of parts and Motorola's proprietary software. And this is the software. Pretty much, with the exception of the gentleman that just spoke that has a programming package, I haven't seen it. But prior to that, most of the software you bought is exactly this. If you take a hex editor and look through it, every copy has the same serial number and the same copyright to this European firm. Anyway, this is a Motorola transceiver. I'm sure most of you have probably seen it. The way this software works is you can make a cable that plugs into the parallel port of your computer, plugs into the phone, and it allows you to alter whatever game you want to inside it, technically. We'll try to get this stuff up and running here in a minute. But getting back to the firmware problem, the version number, a company called California Grapevine Communications has just released a box, an ESN transfer device, which is one of the prototypes or one of the ones they're actually selling. See, I'm really organized. I threw all this stuff in a box about 10 minutes before we were ready to hit for the airport. Too much to it, at least on the surface. What this actually is, it emulates the device Motorola leases to their authorized service centers called an identity transfer box that allows a defective cell phone to be connected to it and then a loaner phone or just another transceiver attached to the other side. You enter some keystrokes while it's in test mode. And the loaner or the defective phone transfers its serial number and all the other data into the loaner phone, and the defective phone is then written with a serial number of 0000 or 000FFFF. And the phone's returned to Motorola for repair. Once it's repaired, it's attached to the identity transfer unit again, and the keystroke sequence is entered, but exactly the opposite. And the NAM data is written back into the hopefully repaired phone and out of the loaner. And the loaner phone is then ready again to be used while someone else's phone is in service. This device basically emulates that unit. And working with a Series 4 transceiver, essentially it eliminates the firmware problem that people have had in copying one of their cellular phones into another one of their cellular phones. Because this particular Series 4 transceiver, and I guess most of them, can be programmed by this standard Motorola software that you can download from wherever or pay a couple hundred dollars for if you feel like it through an ad. And the way it works, it's $50 over here. Essentially, it just plugs into the DB25 connector, and your other phone, I think we had a flip phone to kind of do this with. All right, here's a flip phone. We won't change any serial numbers tonight or harm any animals while we do this. Someone from the FCC might be here. Never going to look at me, I know. Budget cuts. Worked for a broadcasting chain, and I never see that FCC anymore. I've got to plug a few things in now. I actually used it on a 486. I altered my bias. This might not work. First thing I should tell you is the Motorola software that we've been discussing that's floating around everywhere It's like reading Quick Basic or something. And it works, but it's junky. It's really timing sensitive. And I run it on a 46 DX50, and I usually have to go into my BIOS and slow the machine down and adjust wait states on the AD bus and stuff to make it work on it. But, for demonstration purposes, I think we'll be alright. We're running out of plugs. We might not be able to do this. The general principle involved is that if you're somebody is already using this software on older Motorola phones, the same programming cable is used. And in the case of a flip phone, it's just like the power connector, it's just wired a little differently to a DB25 cable. We'll be having a schematics or diode-protected programming cables in the back a little later for basically photocopy charges. Just plug into the data port. The test mode connector between the battery terminals on the back with that little clip hanging from it. This one, this power connector does. It depends what company's power connector you buy. Somebody made a comment that the power connectors that plug into the data port or the power port on the bottom of the phone don't always have all the pins. It depends what brand you buy. Some have all the pins and they're not connected. Some don't have all the pins. When I first tested this software about a year ago and it started being advertised in nuts and bolts, I pretty much just stripped some wire and bent it into the little troughs of the connector, put a little super glue on it, and it held together for a few insertions. Yeah. In any event, we're out of plugs. I guess we're not going to be able to do too much. We need the plug in, like, the hackers are hacking. I'm starting to remember how this worked. I'm getting confused. I'm sure I'm confusing you now, too. And when it doesn't work, you get this message that says fail on the screen. Basically, what this does is the little interface has a... ...has a small toggle switch for program and for test mode. While the switch is in test mode, you can punch in #66# on one phone, #69# on the other, which is Motorola's built-in ESN transfer routine. The interface box activates Motorola's own routines, which are caused all the data, the serial number, the mobile number, your repertory memory, everything pretty much, to transfer out of the phone and into your Series 4 transceiver. Once that's done, can use the Motorola software to edit whatever parameters you're trying to edit on the host phone, so to speak, and which is compatible with the software, since these aren't directly. And you flip the switch then into transfer mode and reverse the keypad sequences, and the data you just edited all transfers back into the phone that you're actually trying to work with. Okay, he wanted to know if you've activated the transfer sequence and transferred the information from one phone, the target phone, into the host phone, does this phone still work? And the answer is no. The serial number will be essentially zeroed out, so it won't work. When you go to transfer it back, Motorola's own firmware will read the serial number in this phone to make sure it's zeroed out before it tries to transfer the information back. It's kind of a safeguard that they implemented into the software. I don't think we're going to have too much success in getting this thing right. I'm going to try to read the volunteers book on it. Anyway, in the meantime, are there any questions about cellular in general that anyone has? I'm going to go to the next one. file sizes being different? I've really, he was asking about the file size difference in some of the Motorola software that's around, and I haven't really looked. It seems like a couple of the few samples I did compare were from quite some time ago, and we have a copy up on a VBS. It was had some of the graphics and things changed by the high-tech hoods in New York. But I haven't really noticed. I mean, it seems that in functionality, it's all the same. There have been a number of people that have made claims in advertising about the software they were selling being able to work with newer versions of phones, and essentially it was just it was all bogus. There's someone, I think, in Ohio that if you call a number in their ad, you'll get an interesting voicemail message saying that modified cell phones is illegal, they had some equipment seized and things like that. Although from what I've heard, which I haven't confirmed, is that that individual actually got in trouble because they were selling cables, and they didn't ship the cables with the software, so people complained to the Postal Service, and so they got in trouble with the post office and not like the FBI. The software itself is not illegal. It may be infringing on some of the intellectual property rights, but it's everywhere, and I have yet to see a complaint or hear anyone say anything other than the gentleman that operates Spy Supply. He's essentially unhappy when anyone does anything that remotely competes with what he's trying to do. But, he's pretty much behind the times. He's leeching technology from people, trying to buy things from Kingpin, if you know him, and Kingpin. He'll let it go free before he ever lets that person know about it. Again, I don't know the man personally, so I just know what I hear. Allegations. There are different variations. A lot of it has to do with grounding and things like that. My answer to that is that if it works, it works, and it doesn't, it doesn't. If it reads the NAM data at all, usually the software aborts when you're trying to write to the ESN because it's really I/O intensive. It's writing into the phone and then reading parts back out, trying to match checksums. And in the corner of the screen, there's a busy idle feel, and it'll just, so rapidly toggle back and forth as it's reading and writing, that's usually when there's a failure. And it's not usually related to the cable. If you can read the NAM, your cable's fine. The failure is usually due to timing of the PC, which may not be our problem here. I don't want to sit here for half an hour and mess with it. So I've had to sit in front of my computer for 2 or 3 hours adjusting to CMOS, finding to make it work reliably. Generally, if I'm testing stuff, I change the ESN, I have to put it back. And for a while, I had a flip phone with a 000 FFF ESN because the firmware version was too high to work with the software. And if you try to use this type of software with firmware that's above the 9121 cutoff, you end up with the 000 FFF and the ESN. And well, the phone operates, but you're never going to be able to place a call with it unless you can convince your cellular carrier that your phone's serial number 000FFFF and they'll program it in the database for you. But of course, then all kind of people will have copies of your phone. If the call comes in at the same time,
look around,
if both phones are in use, if you have... Sorry about the interruption. To answer your question, if you copy one of your phones into another phone, if you clone your phone so that you can have, say, one in your car and one that you can carry in your purse, if you use them both at the same time, if they're both turned on at the same time, because the phone registers when you first turn it on, it transmits to the cell site and identifies itself. Service will probably be denied if you're both in the same service area. If one of you is roaming, it may take a few minutes, but you'll set off fraud flags. There are people who have alleged that the cellular systems have really sophisticated software that can triangulate automatically, and that's all bullshit. I mean, people believe what they're saying, I'm sure, but you know, I talk to a lot of people in the industry and in the Bay Area, and they just don't do that. The only thing they can, they're developing more advanced systems right now to detect cloning, but essentially two phones on at the same time will trigger the fraud flag. And also, technically, it's illegal because you're consuming twice the resources at one time that you're paying for. If you have two phones, like the phones in your house, if you only use one at a time, make one call at a time, then same thing with cellular, you're paying for everything you're using. So once you have two phones on at once, you're locking up two transceivers, two channels on a T1 somewhere, making a switch do have to work, extra work, and I guess they could come after you. As far as triangulation, people have asked about that. Because the cellular network uses arrays of directional antennas, in Sacramento, for example, there was a man who was threatening to commit suicide. He called his wife from his cell phone, and the sheriff's department called Cellular One. Cellular One had to go to the computer and actually pull it and ask it what transceiver, what cell site the call was coming from. Once they know what site it's coming from, that narrows it down to however many transceivers happen to be in the site. One transceiver is used per phone call, and they're just combined onto different antennas. Based on that, they were able to pull out maps to show the coverage contour of their antenna array. So they pretty much know, you know, that their antenna provides coverage to a particular chunk of area, and then the next cell over array covers the next chunk of real estate. So they can narrow it down to about 2 miles. But it's not really sophisticated direction finding, especially in areas, again, where I'm from, Sacramento, where some cells cover 20 miles. Signal strength comes into play as well. Any more questions? If you use the test clip, the PROM replacement, yes, you have to open the phone every time you're going to alter any of the data. It piggybacks on top. It's, you know, 2 inches tall. Well, the quad clip 32, the little test clip you use, runs about $40, $45 from DigiKey, places like that. PROM is, I don't know, $6. So, I mean, to me, it's about $50 worth of parts, but it tends to sell for $275 to $295 just for the unit. And the software inside the chip seems to be just old Motorola software, so depends on whether you respect their copyright on that. This interface from CGC with a Series 4 transceiver, whatever I ended up here, sells for about $900. There'll be a review of it, I believe, in the September issue of Nuts and Bolts, because I just missed the deadline for the August issue. Anything else? you're asking about a low-powered cell system? Like PCS? There's... if you're talking about PCS or... There's a lot of services that people are talking about that basically that's all they're going to be doing for a long time. And I don't know. There's PCS, there's Motorola's working on Iridium, and they're actively soliciting investors. Things like that. I can't answer the impact on that. Ultimately, what they're looking to do is give us one phone number, and that phone number will follow us and be used everywhere we go, somehow, some way, through a network, whether it's doing it wireless or using a remote, a little base station in your house, whatever. Well, since it doesn't really, well, I guess they're testing, you know, experimenting with it in some places, but it doesn't really exist in any marketable form, so it's hard for me to say too much about how it differs, other than what I've read, that it uses smaller cells, low power. It's different from the digital cellular system, in that the digital system uses the existing infrastructure, and rather than carry on the voice conversations in analog form, they're able to chop up one voice frequency and multiplex multiple digitized audio onto the same voice channel. Interesting thing where they talk about security and whatnot, and while it may be much more difficult to demultiplex and decode your digitized conversation, as far as fraud is concerned, all the systems still set up the call on analog channels. So your ESA, even with the new digital phone, is being transmitted just like it always was on one of 21 control channels. And at that point, once the cell and the phone handshake and decide that they're both digital, then the command will be issued to go into a digital mode and move to another channel. Any more questions? I don't think the flip advantage. He's asking about if there's any advantages to a flip phone instead of a handheld brick type ultra classic Motorola phone for experimentation. In his experience, the handheld has been easier to program and work with. And I don't think that there's any advantage to the flip phone. All the phones have the same diagnostic mode, the same type of data interface. I think flip phones are just cooler, you know. It's hard for me to answer. I don't know if they're harder to hook up to. Well, if that's what you're doing, then yeah, you're not exactly experimenting with it. If you're changing the serial number, you're doing something else. So I'm not saying you are, but to be honest, I think that's why flips are more popular. You know, they're hipper, they're cooler, if you're stealing phone service or doing whatever some people do with phones, they'd rather have, you know, their cool little flip phone to go with their beeper and cocaine. But that's not exactly the subject of the discussion. Drug dealers, I say that just because drug dealers have a propensity to use clone phones, and it's not because they don't want to pay for service, but it's because they don't want their calls traced. The FBI cannot, or any law enforcement agency cannot execute a warrant or for a wiretap if they don't know your phone number. So if you're using some grandma's cellular service, they're not going to find you. Anyway, that's it for us. Thanks. Okay, Drunk Bucks is reminding me that in the back we'll have some, you know, we need to make some money, we need to eat some more. We have a couple copies of this book thing on the Candy Radio Shack cellular hardware, written by a hacker named Judas Girard. I edited it, we're selling it through Phoenix Rising Communications. We also have some cabling diagrams that work with the Motorola software. for flip phones, the handheld and the bag phones. And these wire diagrams differ in that they're like a curved revision. They have diodes in the right places to keep you from frying your computer. Some people blow up their parallel board cards for whatever reason. Also, there's a pinout conversion for the modular, the little RJ45 jack on the side of the transceiver, because some transceivers you can't program without making a little conversion because the jack is complicated. I'll just leave that alone. If you're in that boat, you know what I'm talking about. You can deal with it. Also, if you're interested, we have a few copies of the documentation that goes with the CGC unit. If you are interested in getting that and checking it out, you can do that. California Grapevine Communications. Their email address is cgc@prcomm.com. cgc@prcomm.com. If you want to send me some email, you can reach me at Damien, D-A-M-I-E-N, at prcomm.com. Nuts and bolts, if you want back issues, you want to subscribe, you can reach them at 909-371-8497. Thank you. Damien, D-A-M-I-E-N, at prcomm, prcomm.com. Yeah, C-O-M. prcomm.com. Radio Shack handhelds aren't covered by the publication because they're different from all the rest. One of the Radio Shack handhelds has a 93C46 serial DEEPROM. Judas has two of them at the moment. One was sold to us by one of our subscribers, and we'll probably be issuing an addendum to the Tandy publication about that. The other ones don't use a standard serial device, and so we're kind of at a loss on how to write any new information into it. But somebody's breaking out some Motorola history over here. I think I have the same phone in my truck, except the box is silver. Yeah, I think so. Have you ever looked at the firmware number in it? Do you know how to put the phone in test mode? Take a little piece of foil or otherwise short out the center connector between the two battery terminals. Slide the battery off the back. There's a recessed terminal. You just take a little wad of foil and stick it in there so that it makes contact with that third. We'll show you in a few minutes. But once you're in test mode, status display will come up. You can issue commands similar to what the Oki will accept. I believe pound 19 pound, I think, will show you the firmware version. Pound 38 pound will show you the... No. Some of the commands will reinitialize the memory inside the phone there. Erase your memory, your stored. Thank you. with computer software. The software that we've seen tonight for scanning cellular channels works only with the OT900. All the phones have a test mode that can be accessed manually. While the phone is in test mode, you can unmute the received audio and then use another command to manually punch in cellular channel numbers to listen to the audio, but they don't spit out data. Questions about the OK900 should be directed to Mark or the cellular software scanning person. I don't know that much about OK900s. Mark actually introduced me to the OK900, and when I get questions from readers about the OK900, I usually send an email to Mark to ask him.